did you go to Dick Cavett? Did Dick Cavett come to you? What was the origin of it?
Well, the idea came from a good friend of mine named Robert Bader, who works with Dick. He's a friend of Dick's. He's Dick's archivist, and he's the vice president of Daphne Productions, which is Dick's production company. And Robert knows the Cavett Library extremely well. And he said, you know, there's like all these Watergate-related shows where Dick had all these people. Can we do something with this? And he and I talked about it and came up with this approach, which to me was great fun and a challenge and interesting, and I think a fresh way to look at history as opposed to doing a straight-ahead historical documentary about the scandal, coming in through the prism of Dick's interviews with many of the principals struck me as a really strong idea.
Right.
So I looked at, with Robert's recommendations, looked at about 50 Cavett shows, and from those, cherry-picked what I felt were the absolute best moments, and that's what we brought together in the show. Connective tissue, a new interview with Dick, new interviews with Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, John Dean, and historian Tim Naftali, who also used to be the director of the Richard Nixon Library and Museum, so he knows whereof he speaks.
But he's the dark-haired guy, right?
I'm sorry?
He's the dark-haired guy with a sense of humor about things.
That's correct.
He's
a great character, and really makes history come alive with his unique perspective.
My impression upon listening to him was, why is he talking so openly about this? If obviously he had to be in the Republican circles and that realm to even be hired. So how is it that he's being so candid? I didn't get it. So.
Well, you know, I think that's his nature. He no longer works for the library, and I think he's free to take a more objective viewpoint now.
Okay.
But actually, the Nixon Library had been run by the family, largely. And when it was taken over by the National Archive, they brought in Tim to objectify it more, because if you had gone down there in the days when the family was running it, you wouldn't even know Watergate happened.
Yeah,
they made no reference to it at all. Tim really broadened out the perspective, and in the course of his work, he listened to a lot of the Watergate tapes, and I think that very much informed his perspective today.
One of the key clips, the funnier ones, is when Vidal and Cavett pretty much hatched the term Watergate junkie. And they talk about they're actually wake up in the morning and they need another fix. And that's not untrue, because there was a kind of an endorphin rush you got, or some kind of a heroin high that you got from each new revelation. And what this show does, this by the way, 55-minute, hour-long show that was mischaracterized as being 90 minutes by the Los Angeles Times, is that it whets your appetite for those endorphin rushes, and it takes you back into that thing. And it's one of the great news stories of all time, so that's why I really wish it had been 2 hours at least, if not, it's certainly 90 minutes, because it's just, you want to like revel in that stuff. It's so much fun. It's so much joy, really.
Well, I wish we'd had more time as well, but we were grateful to have this opportunity. And,
but somebody at PBS has said, "Listen, I don't want to get too much into this. Just we'll give you an hour. That's it."
I think that's kind of what was available, So we, we found so much great stuff. There were a number of sections that I had built with my editor, and we just didn't have the time for them.
We did one on
Who Was Deep Throat. We did one on the Saturday Night Massacre, where Nixon ended up firing his attorney general, his deputy attorney general, and others. We did one on should Nixon have burned the tapes. Dick did a very interesting interview many years later with Alexander Haig, where Haig admits that he had recommended to Nixon that Nixon burn the reasons.
Yeah.
Nixon and Haldeman, in some bizarre point of view, decided that the tapes would ultimately exonerate Nixon. And of course, the absolute opposite was true. So, but that was the fun for us was looking at all the footage to decide what was going to make it in the show and what wouldn't. We looked at many hours of the Watergate hearings, and as you describe, it's so true. There was not only an endorphin rush, but there was this sort of edge of your seat viewing experience where you didn't know what these people were going to say and what new revelation would come out of someone's mouth. And the other thing I think one watches it today and wishes that we had the same sort of bipartisan outrage towards things or bipartisan cooperation towards things, which is really non-existent in Washington today. But you can really see it on the committee that the Republicans were just as outraged by Nixon's behavior as were the Democrats.
Well, the ones with backbone and principles like Barry Goldwater were, but what I think you didn't really get into, and I remember being there was a certain adamant faction who were with Nixon no matter what, and their basic creed, their rallying cry was, "Don't confuse us with the facts."
Absolutely right. Well, there's a, again, we had a section that we built that there just was no time for. It was the day before Nixon resigned, and he had every intention of fighting to remain president. And he called Goldwater and two other top congressional Republicans over to the White House, and he said, "I'm going to fight this thing. I want you to tell me how many votes I have." And Goldwater reportedly said to him, "Mr. President, you may have three or four votes, and mine is not one of them." And Nixon knew at that moment he was done, and so the next night he resigned. And,
Wait, was that line in your doc?
No.
Well, that's a pretty good line. Why would you want to not use that?
Well, you know, Jeffrey, you've been around the film industry a long time and television, and it's just at some point you end up having to make extremely difficult decisions because you have a certain time frame to fit into. And the question is, okay, if we leave that in, what has to come out to make time? So it was one of those kinds of...
It runs 55 minutes. What, couldn't you have made it 57 minutes?
No, we had a very specific time slot to fit into, so that's all we had. But that, I mean, there's some really cool stuff like that. But what was really interesting to me, right, even from the beginning, and we do, and Dick makes a note of it, is he had read the story in the New York Times, and it turned out that on that Monday night after the break-in, Teddy Kennedy was on his show. And already he's talking about it. And I kind of watched that clip, for example, and I wonder what Kennedy knew. I wonder if the Democrats didn't kind of get together on Sunday to kind of evaluate what had happened the night before and to sort of figure out what was going on. But so many of
How could anybody with a education above eighth grade or an IQ above 75 not realize there was obviously a connection given the links to the committee to reelect and so on between the burglars? I mean, these things don't happen as wildcat renegade moves on the you know.
I think a little easier to say from this perspective, but I think Woodward said it in his interview with me, is he said, you know, the cover-up was working, is that they managed to confuse the issue and paper over it and do all these things, and I think people didn't, at that time, Americans weren't willing to look at their president and say, well, of course he had something to do with that, he must have. We were still at a time, I think, where there was a bit of naivete about our leaders, and I think we see that with people's reactions to what was going on. It wasn't really until the hearings brought so much of this forward to the public that they began to say, well, now, wait a minute. And that was really kind of interesting. The other thing that struck me is how, in his own witty, preppy, Dick Cavett way, he asked some very tough questions of these people. And I love his interview style, which is to ask a smart question and get out of the way. It wasn't about him. It wasn't him trying to be funny. It wasn't him trying to... He would let these people talk and either make their case or hang themselves. And I just find that really very impressive. I mean, when you look at what he was doing as opposed to what the other two top talk show hosts of the era were doing, Johnny and Carson and Merv Griffin. I mean, Dick really had conversations. It wasn't it was entertaining, but it was also he had conversations with people. You know, Johnny, we looked at one of the nights that Dick had a Watergate guest on. Johnny had some big-breasted new singer on, you know, and so that's what they were doing. And here's Cavett dealing with these serious issues that are affecting the country, and I think you have to look at him and really admire that.
Johnny Carson was the country, though. That's the thing about Johnny Carson. He was the popular choice of most Americans. Cavett was the favorite of the people in the arts and the intelligentsia and the people in New York and Los Angeles, but most of the country lived in Johnny Carson's house back then.
Oh, very much so. I mean, Johnny was, you know, had twice the size of the audience that Dick did. The irony, though, Jeffrey, is by today's standards of what constitutes a hit.
Yeah.
You know, Dick, even in second place, had a larger audience than Jimmy Fallon and Jay Leno and Dave Letterman have today.
Really?
Yeah, because there were only three choices back then. You know, it was ABC, CBS, and NBC. That was it. You know, now the audience has so many choices. It's a much more diffused group.
So the portions of the viewing audience that Fallon and the others today have are smaller than the percentage that Dick Cavett was.
That's correct. Of the complete audience.
Who
yeah,
was on right. CBS at the time? Do you recall? Who was the CBS late night thing?
Well, it was interesting. Dick was on late night from 1969 to 1975 on ABC.
Right.
Carson was on NBC, and CBS had tried Merv Griffin in that slot from 69 to 72. And Merv just wasn't working, and ultimately he didn't like being opposite Johnny, so he dropped out and went to daytime, where he was for the rest of his career.
Yeah.
And CBS filled it up with late night movies.
Right.
So it was Carson, Cavett, and late night movies, and I guess depending on the movie, Dick was either number two or number three.
Yeah.
Johnny clearly was the choice, and for good reason, you know. But I'm not in any way being critical of Johnny. It's more just kind of looking at what Dick did and admiring it. And the other thing, I mean, Dick had, and this fits in very much to the concern that the Nixon administration had, was Dick pulled in the college audience. He had young demographics, and you see that in, for example, the music guests that Dick would have.
Yeah.
Dick had Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and Joni Mitchell and David Bowie and Paul Simon, and he had kind of the young, hot artists at the time,
right,
and who loved coming on to Dick's show.
Right.
And, you know, Johnny, of course, much more general entertainment, but... you hear in the White House tapes just a little bit of what we have in our show, but when you listen to the tapes in general, there was a concern that Cavett really would dominate the younger audience that would be voting in 1972 and again in 76.
Mm-hmm.
So they would try to find ways to... So as much as they would put Cavett down, and you heard that in our show,
yeah,
they also tried to get on,
yeah,
get their spokespeople on, because they knew that they would be reaching an audience that they didn't get with Johnny or some other avenues.
Right. Well, I think it's also a general lesson that the notion of an informed electorate being attuned, or at least having an interest in trying to learn something, that took really, the break-in in June of 72, and as you said, only until the hearings, like I guess John Dean was the first big impact. But, you know, how many people, at what point were people actually starting to say that this is a very serious infraction and something pretty calamitous in the history of our country, and this can't just be PR'd away, and, you know, this is really something? When did that consensus seem to arrive from what you know of the statistics in 73 and 74? When did people actually start to really get on board and realize what this was?
I think it started at the end of January 73 when Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and the five burglars were convicted. And I think people began to say, well, no, wait a minute, you know, they're convicted.
No, wait a minute. It wasn't just an accusation.
There
wasn't a conviction, though. The thing with them was, as I recall, that Sirica said to them, Judge Sirica, that you have to cough up and tell me what it is, or I'm going to throw the book at you. And they finally said, okay, we'll tell you.
Yeah, and it had come out. So that was the beginning of it. And then about 8 days after they were convicted, Teddy Kennedy proposed the creation of the Senate Watergate Committee.
Okay.
And then, interestingly enough, again, we talk about the bipartisanship here.
Right.
There were no dissenting votes from the Republican Party. Everybody voted to create this committee.
Yeah.
The hearings began in May, continued through August of 73.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can probably track it to John Dean. I think people were starting to get the sense that something was amiss here.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until Dean got up and in a opening statement that, as I recall, ran something like 7 hours that he read, he disclosed really the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tim Naftali, I think, put it in really good perspective for us. So then it kind of became Dean versus the president. Who's telling the truth? And I think there was still, you were talking about it before, there was still that portion of America that either was in great denial, didn't want to believe Nixon would be involved with this, or simply didn't believe he was. And so we believe him. And then it was, well, but, you know, it's the president versus this young lawyer, what are we going to do? And then Alexander Butterfield comes up and tells about the recording equipment in the White House and in the executive office building. And suddenly, what now will unfold is there's proof.
Yeah.
That Dean's recollections were really close to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And then people had no choice but to say, wait a second. There's a great moment that I think most people won't notice. But in our show, the clip from the hearings, when Butterfield is asked by the Republican counsel, were there listening devices in the White House? If you look carefully over his shoulder, there's a whole table of reporters who are making notes. And this one reporter's head whips around like, what did he say? Listening devices? And I think, you know, you're looking for a moment. That's an interesting moment where I think people didn't really want to believe this, or there was not enough evidence to believe it. But at that moment, the evidence is now going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there were still defenders of Nixon well into 1974. And you probably will remember this, but there was a big fight over the tapes, possession of the tapes. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right.
And in late July, Nixon loses the case. He's got to turn over the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
He turns over, and it was like 10 or 12 or 15. I don't know the exact number. They turn over these tapes, and amongst them is what has come to be called the smoking gun.
Yeah.
And that came out at the end of July, I think July 28th or 29th, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the conversation between Haldeman and Nixon just a few days after the burglary, where they're talking about it, and already Nixon is orchestrating the cover-up.
Right.
So all of his, well, I didn't know anything about it, the White House had nothing to do with it, all of a sudden there it is in his own words, and there's nothing he can do about it.
Mm.
And then the House Judiciary Committee is starting to vote articles of impeachment, and then comes this visit to the White House that I mentioned to you from Goldwater and the other Republican leaders. And really, the pressure was just too strong on Nixon then. Mm-hmm. And by that time, you see it in those man on the street interviews that we included in the show, where those were filmed in Republican cities. Some of them were shot in Wilmette, Illinois, which is as Republican as you can get, and the other one is Chagrin Falls, Ohio, and they were starting to turn on him, and I think that's where the evidence just became so overwhelming that even the greatest Nixon defenders could no longer say, oh, it's just his enemies going after him. You know, here it became quite clear that what he was doing here.
Mm. Well, seems to me the general feeling you get from reviewing all this and watching your show is that the tools of democracy, to keep a democracy and make it as healthy and workable a system as possible, are obviously there. But there's a great, great reluctance on the part of most people to even open that box, much less get the tools out, much less use them. They really rather just cruise along, you know, bring in the paycheck. You know, have the turkey on Sundays, leave me alone, you know. That's what the way most people are in that space. I mean, they're just not interested in being engaged.
I think there's great truth to that. But there is also great truth. Bernstein said it to me when I interviewed him. We didn't, it didn't make the final cut, but what he said was that in many ways, what this experience did was to show that the system worked. That ultimately Nixon did not get away with what they were trying to get away with because the system worked.
Right.
It took a bit. It was a bit of a challenge, but it did work.
Mm. And do you think that that Ford was accurate in saying that had he not pardoned Nixon, that the whole thing would have gone on for another 2 and possibly even 6 years? Is that, do you think that's an accurate assessment of probably what would have happened?
I do. I absolutely do. I'll tell you what struck me. You know, Jeffrey, again, you talk to a lot of filmmakers, much higher profiles than me, and the reason that a filmmaker will let something stay in a film is there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And same thing here, too. It's my way of agreeing with Ford. But I have to tell you, Dick did 2 interviews with Ford. The first one was in 1974, just about a month after he was confirmed to replace Spiro Agnew. And you see a little excerpt of that. And then he did another one in 1979, after Ford had been president.
Mm-hmm.
And in watching those 2 interviews, I came away with a much greater respect and understanding of Ford than I ever had. I think I was probably, like so many people, influenced by what Chevy Chase did to him. You know, that he was this rumbling, bumbling, stumbling guy.
Right.
You know, but in both interviews with Dick, he's straightforward. He's not manipulative. He's not giving you the usual spin. He seemed to be giving very from the heart kind of answers, and didn't duck Dick's very difficult questions.
Yeah.
So particularly in the 1979 interview, and Dick says it in my interview with him, but I thought this should have had more press attention at the time, that one president would say of another president that he was guilty. That in essence, to give a pardon and to accept one is acceptance of guilt.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's like really fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
That he would say that. And so in not so many words, he's saying Nixon was guilty, which I thought that was really a revelatory moment.
Right.
But I absolutely do believe it. I mean, you saw it. Even from 72 to 74 in the Washington Post coverage that then expanded after Walter Cronkite began to cover it on the national news. But not a day went by in 73, 74 where there wasn't some article, some new perspective or viewpoint on what was happening here. And I have to think that Ford's assessment was correct, that I think they knew Nixon was going to be indicted had he not resigned by the special prosecutor, and that every day there'd be some, here's the latest on what's going on, you know, and that would have gone on from anywhere from, I think Ford says, anywhere from 2 to 6 years, and it would have really dominated the country in a way that would not have been good for the country. And I think that, too, Jeffrey, is a really interesting thing, that you have Woodward and Bernstein, who are these two guys that whose feelings about Nixon and Ford were quite clear at the time.
Yeah. Sorry.
Who can now look back and say, we were wrong.
Yeah, right.
We were livid, but we shouldn't have been, because it really was a very courageous act, and I absolutely believe that to be true. And I think Ford should be looked at in a much different light than he was at the time.
I got to tell you, I felt a little moved in that direction, nudged in that direction myself for the first time. It was that conversation that I did not recall that specifically, and the rationale about as you just explained it, but I guess from the 70, was that 75 when he spoke to him? I guess from that perspective, I guess it wasn't that shocking or I mean. To admit or acknowledge Nixon's guilt, because it seemed to be so overwhelming and unmistakable.
I guess, you know, it would not have surprised me if he took typical politician's viewpoint and sort of gave a non-answer, you know. But it's what I like about Ford, is that he quite openly answered all of Dick's questions, which I think was really nice. I mean, there's another thing. I mean, we were talking before about Johnny and Merv and those kind of guys. In that first interview with Ford from early 74, where he says, now there's been some, Dick says to Ford, there's been some conversation that there may be criminal charges coming against the president. If that's true and you become president, would you give him clemency? It's like, whoa! You know, Johnny and Merv aren't going to ask that question. You know, Dick did, and I just had to admire that. Just go, wow, Dick, great.
If I had been your producer and you had been given clearance to make a 90-minute version, there would be an inescapable, absolutely necessary thing to put in, which is that if you take out or look away briefly from the paranoid tendencies in his personality and offensive victimization and the feeling that politics was a rough and tumble, dirty game, and you had to hit them as hard as they were hitting you, and that's the way Nixon saw, you know, the world of politics. If you look away from that and just say, okay, let's put that in a box, let's look at the rest of what he was as a president, and you look at his policies and his assessments, he was really a pretty good president. He wasn't that bad, and he was actually healthcare, you know. Everything. He wasn't that bad, and by today's barometer of what is liberal, what is centrist, he was about a center right at most. He certainly wasn't hard right, and he was by liberal standards today, Nixon wasn't that bad. He really wasn't.
Well, he was going for health care, and he was had opened up a relationship with Communist China and all of those things. Well, it's interesting. I asked that very question. So if you were my producer, I would have been listening to you, because I asked that question of Woodward and Bernstein, Dean and Naftali.
Yeah.
And each of them had a little slightly different perspective. I said, but, you know, had Watergate not occurred, how would Nixon be viewed as a president? And they all had very different things, but they all acknowledged that he had some genuine accomplishments, particularly in the field of foreign policy. But he also gave 18-year-olds the vote. He pushed that. He was pushing for health care when all of this Watergate thing emerged. So, yes, I think there were some good things that he did. But and there are apologists for Nixon who even today say, well, you know, yes, what he did was wrong, but, you know, other presidents did things just as wrong, which to me is no defense particularly, but the thing was, he did do these things.
Yeah.
He did lie, and he did manipulate, and he did try to orchestrate, and it was all bad activity, and I think we were better off to have had him resign.
All right, man. Enjoy your Sunday, but thank you very much for talking with me, and I hope that if not you and I, that somebody figures out if there's going to be a rebroadcast, because I think listen to this.
Well, you know, as I was saying to you the other day, PBS is not a network like ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. They can only suggest that the show should be Friday night at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Each station in the system, and there's almost 400 of them, have the wherewithal to decide, A, if they are going to carry a show, and B, when they're going to carry it.
Mm-hmm.
And based on whatever local programming criteria comes into their head, they'll make that decision. It's like Pittsburgh, for example, is showing it in 2 weeks. North Carolina is showing it on September 1st. But PBS doesn't update me on every broadcast of every on every station, so that's why I don't really know. But
well, if you go to pbssocal.org, which I think covers KOCE, and there's another PBS station somewhere in the Southland. Exactly where, I'm not sure, but I know that the dominant, it used to be, what was the station that was here for decades?
It was KCET.
And they, what happened to them?
They got into a disagreement with the network over fees and control and things, and they left the system about 3-4 years ago, and KOCE became
right.
Public television for
right.
for this part of the world. What I will say, perhaps they're not as organized as they should be on their website with in terms of programming, but I'm really proud of this show and very pleased that they bought it, and they may have been the only ones who would have bought it. I don't know, but they did, and I'm really, really pleased about it.
I know that when you type out Dick Cavett's Watergate into the search engine at pbssocal.org,
yeah.
nothing comes up. So that apparently they seemingly don't have any intention of rebroadcast, which seems really, really ill-advised. Because, you know, not everybody was Johnny on the spot watching this show on Friday as they should have. I didn't even know about it for some reason until Saturday morning. And then I went, oh, I want to see it. Well, I saw it online. It's not, obviously, it's easy. But interestingly enough, you know, in today's market, the Blu-ray is the disc of choice because of the quality, obviously. And DVDs are hanging on for dear life, pretty much.
Yes.
And they're not worth what they used to be. I mean, it's wonderful to have a good DVD of anything, and if you play it on your system, it looks good. That's fine. But what I'm saying is they're charging like $29 for your, you know, that, it's not worth $29, guy. I got to break it to you. It's like a $15 or $20, you know, it's just $29 is way more than it should be priced. And they even get that wrong, so.
My job is to make shows, and I will tell you one thing. Probably the best praise one could have, and I thought the LA Times review was wonderful.
Yeah,
it was very nice that she said those things.
Right.
But the one I was really concerned about was how Dick Cavett would view this.
Mm-hmm.
He was so close to it; it's so much part of who he is.
Yeah,
and. He and I were on a, with Tim Naftali, we were on a panel at the TCA, the Television Critics Association.
That's the end?
Yeah, at the end of July.
Yeah.
And Dick, we had just finished the show the night before, and I got him a DVD, and he watched it, he and his wife watched it in their room, and he came down to me, and he gave me a hug, and he said, I would have done it just the same way,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was high praise for
him.
But I know he was very pleased, and it also brought back great memories for him because I think he had not, these shows were in his library, but I don't think he had watched them for quite a long time.
There were a lot of great Cavett shows that I wanted to, and I got in touch with him when I saw him on the street one time in Manhattan. And he, through a woman who worked for the two of them or something, they actually sent me some VHS tapes of some of the ones that I had requested, including the Janet Flanner, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal conflict show. And
mm-hmm.
some others.
Mm-hmm.
So it really should be widely available. On a downloading VOD basis, you know, if you want to watch this or own it digitally, that should be something that they make available. I believe that some kind of collection on DVD has been made available, yes?
Yes. They are actually contemplating doing a available on download or streaming kind of situation, because they're right now in the process of digitizing every show.
Okay.
That he has. Well, and I want to get back to that for a minute. But, yes, in 2005, 2006, Shout Factory put out 4 or 5 DVD sets, thematic sets.
Yeah.
One was Comedy Legends,
right.
One was Hollywood Greats,
right.
One was Rock Icons, and then there was a Ray Charles set and a John and Yoko set.
Yeah.
So I know they are sort of thinking about this. Let me give you Bader some credit here for something. It was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of Dick's shows survived from the late night show in the 70s. What happened was ABC was the third network, and 2-inch videotapes then cost a lot of money. And so what they ended up doing, which a lot of networks did, which is why some shows don't exist from the 50s or 60s or 70s,
uh-huh.
is the network would reuse the tape.
Wow.
And not save things, you know? And
wow.
So it's the bane of any television historians or producer, you know, director like me, you know, when you're looking for something, so, oh, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, some of the Cavett shows didn't exist because the network ended up reusing the tape. And one of them was the show on which Woodward and Bernstein appeared with Dick. And so when you look at our special, those clips of that interview look different. And the reason they look different is that they don't come from the 2-inch videotape. That show was thought to be lost. But once we sold this idea to PBS, I kept saying to Bader, I need that. I got to find that. It's got to be somewhere. How can those guys not be somewhere?
Yeah.
Anyway, he went to work, and deep within the bowels of ABC News, he discovered that for some show in 73, the network had kinescoped a 15-minute segment of Dick's interview with Woodward and Bernstein.
Wow.
And he got that, and we got it. We made it look and sound better than it was, but as you know, a kinescope was a prehistoric technology that had been developed in the late 40s to record a TV show because videotape had not yet been invented.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but somehow in 1973, somebody, and what a kinescope is, you literally put a 16 millimeter movie camera and you train the lens on a TV screen. And then you hook into the TV sound with an alligator clip, and that goes on the film, and that's what you end up with. And that was the only moments that were remaining from that original interview. And so we've got them, and Dick hadn't seen that, Woodward Bernstein hadn't seen it, and thanks to Bader, we were able to have that for inclusion in the special.
Okay. Well, we could talk a lot more, but thank you for your time. I appreciate you sharing some part of your Sunday, and here's hoping that everybody gets to see it again sometime on the air, and there's at least the online option right now, so I'm glad that's there. So,
well, thanks, and thanks for the interest, Jeffrey, as always. I really appreciate it.